Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming so much. We have a gigantic crowd in a gigantic room. I'm Claire Coleman. I'm the president and CEO of the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association, and I'm going to be moderating this morning's session on elements for sexual health providers, things to consider when working with primary care systems. We will take a particular focus on federally qualified health centers, but I do recognize that not everyone in this room has a community health center network or a federally qualified health center in the region in which they're working. And so I think you can take a lot of the principles we're going to be talking about today and think about it in terms of a hospital in your region or another provider class or group that might do primary care services. I want to tell you just a little bit about where we're going in our nearly 2 hours together. I'm going to talk first about how the Affordable Care Act emphasizes the primary care network and what we think the opportunities and challenges are for sexual health providers around the country. And then I'm going to ask my colleague Gayla Winston from the Indiana Family Health Council to talk to you about their experience in Indiana working to develop a network that integrates sexual health and primary care services. And then we're going to ask Bill Smith, the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors, to respond from the perspective of STD membership and to just think about the things that Gayla and I have had to say and raise some points for questions and discussion for thought. Then we're going to come back to me, and I'm going to walk you through about 15 elements, essential elements, that should be considered when thinking about a partnership, a more formal partnership, a connection, a collaborative relationship between a sexual health provider or a sexual health system and a federally qualified health center or primary care system. And there's a handout that everybody got, I hope, walking in the door that addresses those points specifically. So you'll be able to take that with you and refer to it for questions. We're going to take your questions throughout. So after each presenter has a chance to speak, we'll open it up for questions. I think it's a long time to sit without a chance to talk, and I hope that folks will take advantage of the opportunity to come to the mics. There's two mics, and one's that's red, and it's concentrated here in the middle of the room, and then there's a far one that's black. And I know people are sort of concentrated on this side of the room. So please, if you can, use both mics if it doesn't require you to make a really long trek. So we're going to get started. We're going to talk a little bit about primary care as being the winner in the Affordable Care Act. NIFRA spent a lot of time in the last 2 years talking with our members who are publicly funded providers of family planning and sexual health care around the country about how the Affordable Care Act is going to change the work that we do. And the place that we often start is from the Affordable Care Act and what it says about the network of care. There's no question that the Affordable Care Act puts an extraordinary amount of interest, attention, and financial resources into the federally qualified health center system. Now, a federally qualified health center is a specific designation made by the federal government. Those folks qualify, their entities qualify for a section of federal money, much as our STD providers do or our family planning providers do. Federally qualified health center systems qualify for Section 330 grant funds. And while they accept many other sources of public and private money in order to make their systems go, it's that designation as being a federally qualified health center that allows them to access those federal Section 330 funds and a host of other benefits. It's important to note that not every community health center is a federally qualified health center. There is a distinction, and we're going to be talking just specifically about those federally funded health centers around the country. So when I say they're the winner, I want to talk about a few examples of why we would say that's so. The first and most important is an extraordinary influx of funding for the federally qualified health center system. The federally qualified health center system's regular appropriation, annual appropriation from the federal government, is over $1 billion. And they fund a system of about 9,000 health centers, seeing roughly 19 million people with that roughly $1 billion. Their services are comprehensive and must serve people cradle to grave. And if you look at their own data reported to the federal government, the FQHC system's patients are primarily under the age of 5 and over the age of 25. But they see people cradle to grave. That's their mandate. So there's extraordinary new funding coming, and I have two things that I think will show you this a little bit more visually. The federally qualified health centers also get enhanced reimbursement rates. And this was alluded to this morning. Jeff Levy made a mention that the primary care system is going to get paid, its Medicaid rate will go up to where the Medicare rates are. And he made a joke about how only in Medicaid do the Medicare rates look good. That's true. But only the primary care system will receive those enhanced rates for about 2 years under the Affordable Care Act. And FQHCs are also included in the preferred provider network for commercial insurance. These are all things that the Affordable Care Act does for it. So it gives it an automatic preference for commercial insurance and gives it a higher Medicaid rate. The federally qualified health centers also get direct investment for infrastructure. And by that I mean construction of new sites, renovation of existing sites, as well as direct funds for health information technology. In fact, I used to run a Title 10 family planning system in the state of New York. And in 2008 and 2009, my colleagues in the federally qualified health center system called and said, "We just got $20 million. And I was like, "What?" Their whole budgets were like 15. And they were getting $20 million for HIT in direct incentives from the federal government in order to be able to make these huge investments in electronic health technology. So they're getting these investments in infrastructure. And finally, they're getting technical assistance and other support, loan repayment for their workforce, for their clinical workforce, training programs and additional support. All of these things are built into the Affordable Care Act for the primary care network. Now this, the top of the slide isn't there. The top of the slide says federally qualified health centers. This is their regular appropriation. And I want you to note that the funding is in billions. So they're at about $1.5 billion in FY12. This is what their extra money looks like under the Affordable Care Act. So there is roughly $13 billion overall. Most of that money is for new services, to see more people in their networks. But a chunk of the money, about $3.5 billion, has been set aside just for construction and renovation. And I think those of us who've been working in sexual health for a long time, of course, remember and recognize that there's never been a dime for our systems for construction or renovation. They got $3.5 billion over the last 2 years to build out their system. Now, of course, the federal government's not doing that just because they love them. They're doing it because they expect them to double their patient load in the next 2 or 3 years. So I mentioned that federally qualified health centers today see about 19 million patients. Well, the federal government expects that with this new influx of resources, they're going to see about 40 million people in the community health center network. So sometimes I spend a lot of time traveling around the country talking to lots of different groups in lots of different states about how the Affordable Care Act is going to change our service delivery. And every once in a while, someone will put their hand up and say, "Well, we don't have any community health centers in our region." You will. This money means that federally qualified health center systems can expand into regions of the country where they have not worked before. And in fact, there is directive language in the Affordable Care Act that says some of this money has to be used to push community health center networks into regions of the country where they are not working now. So for all of those reasons, it's our position at the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association that primary care is the winner, and we need to reorient ourselves in sexual health to that reality. So let's talk about what we're worried about. We don't like to start with what's positive, right? There's really no point. There is a positive, but let's talk about what we're worried about. So, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know if I move this thing. Okay, sorry about that. So these are so cute. These pictures are so cute. So let's talk about what we're worried about. Well, the first is our piggy bank with the hammer. As always, we're worried about money. Sexual health providers experience, really across the board, a system that's quite weak. We are underfunded over the long haul, and we have had lots of challenges, both in attracting workforce, modernizing our sites, pulling in health technology, and affording new drugs and devices that are the standard of care. All things that we have to address, many, many, many of our challenges really go back to money. Do you have the resources? So when we think about the future, one of our primary concerns is money. One of our next concerns is mission. We really believe that sexual health providers are called in a way that in some cases we think other providers aren't called. Our patients are complicated, their health histories demand attention. We are a place of trust and compassion and of comprehension for many of the patients that we serve. And so we're worried as we think about the future and the integration with other primary care networks about what's going to happen to our mission. This is often expressed around the country, and you may have said it to each other. We do it better. And so what's going to happen to that high-quality, comprehensive way we think about our programs? The third thing we worry about is failure. Lots of fear of failure right now in our systems. We're not going to succeed, so why even try? There's really that sense of we do the best we can, nothing's going to work out. And then finally, there's a concern about time, because it feels like things are changing very rapidly, and a lot of our systems are very, very strained. I had a conversation with a colleague the other day who's $1 million in debt and has $1.5 million left in all assets, cash, investments, $1 million in debt, $1.5 million left. They're not going to make it through the year unless something changes for them. So there is a real concern out in the systems that even if we are excited about the opportunity for mission, interested in partnership, feeling like we have opportunities and looking forward optimistically, that we're just going to run out of time at a certain point and we're not going to be able to take advantage of the opportunity to partner closely. But here's a cheerful guy. So one of the things that we want to think about is, okay, so those are the challenges, we get it. What are our opportunities? So one of our opportunities is that our local family planning sexual health provider is approaching another primary care provider with this idea that we could partner together. We could each do our work in the community. There's going to be lots of need. We could work together. And folks come to us and say, we've done that. We've met with the local community health center system. We've talked about the synergy, the opportunity, the deep need in the community. And what we're hearing is, we're happy to take your referrals. That the primary care system says, sure, you can send your referrals to us. We're going to do that. But there's less of a conversation about referrals going the other way. We perceive that as an opportunity, a chance to educate primary care providers about the quality and comprehension of the programs that we provide and the expertise of our workforce. Already this morning, we've heard a couple people talk about the high quality training and the experience of the STD workforce, and of course, that expertise is also found throughout the sexual health community. So we think it's an opportunity to talk about what we can offer a primary care network, and we encourage people to take that point of view. We've got something to sell to a primary care network. The second thing we often hear people say is the primary care system will tell you that it doesn't have capacity issues. It's not filled. But think about what I said earlier. The new influx of federal resources does not come without expectation. And part of the expectation is that they're going to double the number of patients they see by roughly 2015. In 3 short years. That means nearly every federally qualified health center system is going to have capacity problems. There is no question. So again, there's an opportunity to say, you're going to have more patients than you can handle. We can handle a big chunk of this population. We want to be a part of this network with you. A third concern that we hear is back to the piggy bank with the hammer over its head. Why would a federally qualified health center want to share a patient with you? And this really comes down to a billing question. If they can offer services to that patient, bill for that patient, and get paid, maybe the federally qualified health center isn't going to want to share a patient. Again, we think this goes back to capacity and expertise. If they're not willing to do what you do in the complexity, at the level of complexity at which we do it in STDs and sexual health, then we should do it. And they should be willing to partner with us in that way. And then finally, we hear, at least in family planning, quite a lot, I think you don't hear this as much in sexually transmitted diseases, that our primary care partners say, well, family planning is what we do. It's basic health care. We do that. And then when we ask them exactly what they do, for example, they don't do what we do. So when we say, do you have both kinds of IUDs as well as other long-acting methods of contraception, the most effective but most expensive methods available, the answer is usually, we do the best we can. When we asked them, I actually asked a federally qualified health center that shall remain nameless in the mountain region of this country about, you know, how they were going to do a better job addressing sexual health and particularly women's health. And the director said, well, if you're talking about pap smears, we're going to need more money. So this reaction about, you know, do they actually do STD care? Do they actually do family planning care? I think we're going to wind up learning they actually don't, right? They do the basic. But when it comes to the diving deep, the relationship, the scope of services, we're going to find that they don't do it, and really, they can't do it. And just this morning, we heard this conversation, and Kevin Cranston said, the flow is slow in primary care, right? They have a deliberate way they bring you through the system. So this idea that they're going to somehow make time for the intensive counseling that we might need to do, for the conversations about method or about risk assessment, I think does not seem realistic and, again, creates an opportunity from our point of view to partner and make a persuasive case. So why do you want to do this? Why do you want to partner with primary care? Well, again, we think there's opportunity. So the health system is going to have tremendous demand, tremendous need for providers, tremendous need for systems. And there's going to be more resources available to pay for care. From our point of view, there aren't not that many networks of care available in the country outside of the FQHC system, except for the sexual health system. We're established in every state in the nation. We've got county health departments. We've got private not-for-profits. We've got Planned Parenthood systems. We've got hospital-based care. And yes, in family planning, we have federally qualified health centers, as Gail is going to address. About 10% of the family planning care delivered in the country right now is funded through Title X in federally qualified health centers. So federally qualified health centers are 10% of the network today. They're getting direct federal money to do Title X family planning care. So we already have a network that's knit together of different types of providers that are set state to state, region by region. And as I've said earlier, people like us. They trust us. And they're used to coming to us for care. So we think those are good opportunities ahead. So what's the bad news? The bad news is the sense that there's an unwillingness to partner, at least right now. And as I go around the country, a lot of our providers say, I did it. I met with them. I met with Hudson River Community Health, and they said, I'm happy to take your referrals. And we don't think that's the end of the story. Given how quickly things are going to be changing as patients gain insurance, and the likelihood that every provider system will be flooded. A system that is unwilling to talk now may be willing to talk in 6 months, a year, or 18 months. And so our message to our sexual health providers is there's a lot you can do to get ready now, and you ought to be ready for the conversation. Because whether or not it happens in this year, this fiscal year, this calendar year, these conversations are coming. There's still going to be concerns about whether or not this is really beneficial for sexual health. I think that's a question we're going to be debating for at least a decade. But the reality is we're going to follow the money. And the money is leading towards primary care integration and medical home. So we have an obligation, I think, in the sexual health community to make this as good as it can be for our patients and for the standards that we know are appropriate. There's also a sense that there's some things that could be done at the federal level to make our way smoother. And here I just want to speak specifically to the clash between primary care systems and family planning systems. You know, we both act under different federal programs with different federal rules. So one of the things we hear the most about is that, for example, in an FQHC system and a Title X family planning system, our sliding fee scales are slightly different. We're both required to offer services that are paid for according to income. So we're all on sliding fee scale. But family planning sliding fee scale and the federal qualified health center sliding fee scale are different. And so that's a really simple, in my judgment, fix that the federal government can make for us. We're sitting together in the federal government funding stream, but our rules are different. So there are a couple of things that I think discourage people from working together that can be addressed over the next couple of years that make our way smoother. It says at the very bottom, requirements and conflicts. Sorry about the slide. Okay, so my basic message, obviously, is we need to think ahead and play offense, not defense. What I hear a lot from our sexual health providers all around the country is I don't feel like I have a lot of tools, a lot of resources, and a lot to offer. And my case to you today and all over the country over the last 2 years is that you have a lot to offer. And we need to be thinking now about how to frame that and begin to move in an aggressive way, in an assertive way, in a cooperative way to make arrangements that are good for quality, support the core values of our programs, that are good for patients, and also anticipate and accept the reality of the Affordable Care Act payer system. So with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Gayla Winston. As I mentioned, Gayla is a colleague of mine at the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. She runs the Indiana Family Health Council, which is the Title X grantee in the state of Indiana, but she has also led her organization into being a collaborator and a coordinator of a number of other federal and state resources. She's been extraordinarily creative about how to put public money together to build a network over time. Gayla is also the former chair of the Family Planning Councils of America, which is a national organization of the private, not-for-profit family planning grantees in the country. So I'm thrilled that she was willing to be with us today. Gayla.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire. Can you hear me?
Just keep it close.
Oh, okay. I wanted to first give you a little bit of an idea of what the Indiana Family Health Council is and what it does. It was founded in 1975 after the Title X dollars started coming into Indiana, and its predecessor, which was a part of a foundation, felt that they needed to have a nonprofit to be able to work with this program. And since February of 1976, we've been the only Title X grantee in the state of Indiana. And as a federal, as a nonprofit organization, we do have some flexibility that many of you in state organizations may not have. We have a state-wide scope, and we also have a statewide board of directors, which can be good sometimes. Sometimes pain. But anyway, and what we do primarily is we look at the need for services for family planning and reproductive within our state. And because we don't have enough money to meet the need, we have to prioritize. And we see that as one of our most valuable functions. And then we need to identify agencies that will provide the direct services for us. And then we contract with them, we work with them, and we try to always keep in focus that it's technical assistance and not monitoring or policing. We have few people convinced that's true, but there's still some that don't quite go for that. But it truly is. We like to think of it as a collaborative effort, because if we didn't have people providing those services for us, there's no reason for us to be around. And we have a small staff, but have pretty high skills to be able to work and get a good system in place. And we think we are one of the best in the country. We've also been very involved with STD testing and screening and treatment for the whole history of the organization. Indiana doesn't put a lot of money into public health. Actually, I don't think it puts any state funds into public health, or they're minimal. So that we've always had a need for being creative within the state. And one of the things that Title X programs had that the STD programs didn't have was the location of its clinics in a lot of areas of the state that either had very small health departments that their county commissioners didn't want to do services, or they didn't want to do STD services. So we've worked with the Indiana State Health Department for over 20 years in our chlamydia program. We started putting together a low-cost testing program before the IPP dollars reached us. And so we've worked very closely with them through the years, and it's a real natural fit for us to put the family planning with a pretty strong emphasis on STD testing and treatment and prevention. But our main focus has been family planning. And one of the things, again, looking for providers within the state, we fairly early looked at community health centers. In our region, initially, it was a problem because our regional office for family planning felt that any Title X dollars that went into community health centers were supplanting federal dollars, and that because community health centers already had family planning as part of their mandate, then we didn't need to be going in and giving them money for something they should do. Well, they finally relaxed a little bit in the mid-90s and said that we could put programs that were specifically for teens within the program, because that would allow a distinction between the dollars. And so we contracted with a community health center that was located in a needy area of Indianapolis and started a teen-only program there. If the teenagers came into there, it was basically an adolescent service, and they wanted birth control, then they charged Title X for that visit. We looked at it and said, well, we don't really know how we can tell whether you're really using this dollars for something beyond what you receive your community health center money for. So we went in and tried to figure out ways they could document to be able to show where the real where our dollars were versus their dollars. And as you can imagine, it was a nightmare of paperwork and made no sense whatsoever to spend all of your time keeping track of where your dollars were going. So we asked if it would be at all possible to do a separate family planning clinic. And, you know, it's sometimes you come in with, you know, if we don't do that, we're going to have you, you know, keep track of the time you spend in family planning with this, with the patients versus the other ones. And then, you know, if she comes in with a sore throat and wants family planning, we can't really bill twice. So we made it attractive to them to think about doing a separate facility. And so it's just a clinic. It began as a clinic session within the overall program, and they moved into a separate area, and they trained separate staff, and that seemed to work quite well for them. The program is with us still and is prospering. They have moved with the agency. Part of those billions of dollars has created some absolutely gorgeous new clinic space for the teen clinic. So, and we've had a very positive experience with them. That worked well, and when we were in the expansion mode again, we thought, well, it worked once. Let's see if we can maybe do this again. And so we approached another community health center in another part of the state. And they were not a 330 clinic at the time, and so they were just a state. They had a state-funded community health center. It was a FQHC, but they did not have the federal dollars. So technically, we could go for a full-service clinic with them, and so we funded them, and it must have been lucky time, because right after we gave them the grant, they did receive 330 funding from the feds. And we did get permission from the regional office to implement the full range of services. We set it up as a separate clinic line in the clinic, but there was a shared staff at the front desk and a shared lab and shared pharmacy. And we had a lot of problems with this. It goes back to what Claire was saying with the different rules and regs. And it was very difficult for the front desk staff to know which sliding fee scale to have them apply to. And when they got to the pharmacy, you know, we got into who paid for it and all of that. So it was very, very confusing, and there was just a lot of problems, and we had trouble growing the program. So the executive director of the Community Health Center came to me, and we talked about the fact that they were having an expansion with their services, and they really needed the space of the family planning program. Now, this is kind of a for those in family planning that are in mixed environments, this is a universal theme. When they need your space, all of a sudden, or they need more space, we're always first on the list for them to take our space. But when she said that, we said, well, this could be an opportunity. Is there a way? And we talked about possible spaces. And we put them in a totally different building. It was one that had their WIC program in it. It was not the same as the Community Health Center. And we had all the staff only working for that program. And lo and behold, we had a doubling of patients the first year. And for any of you who've moved services, you know usually that first year you lose some in the transition. But we were able to double it. And right now it's four times the size that it was when we moved into separate. And they've kind of gone full circle. And with the building boom, they now are back in the original building. And they're the only thing there. The Community Health Center's gone into a real nice facility. But we had a really excellent working relationship, and a lot of it was we had an executive director who really believed that these services were different, were special, and needed to be provided to their patients. And we have worked with them so well that when we entered into a new phase for us, where the State Health Department gave us their federal family planning funds to manage with the Title X, and we did expansion, this group went from one site to five sites throughout a section of the state. And they did have some problems with that from the federal CHC folks, in that they could not get all of the privileges of a FQHC if they only provided the single family planning services. So these folks were so dedicated that they went ahead and got the separate insurance and took the lower Medicaid rate to be able to provide these services. So those were really positive and good experiences. So we decided, well, let's do this some more. This seems like a good partner. Now I have to get to the part that's the bad. Okay, we've had some difficulties trying it. We've tried it one, two, three, four other times with community health centers and four other sections of the state. And we had one where it was a brand new FQHC, and they just couldn't get it together. And we felt that they were using the money to pay the staff, but they really weren't seeing any patients. So that we felt that was a problem. We had another one who insisted they didn't want it, that they wanted everyone on their staff trained, because they would keep it separate, which was one of our rules, but they wanted all of their staff to be able to work in it. And once we trained them, they came back and said, no, we just don't think that we want an outside group telling us how to provide our services. And so we stopped that one. We had another one who the same thing, as they felt, well, we don't want to do a single service. We don't want to spend all that time with the patient only on this one topic. And then we had another one who withdrew after a year because she felt that, quote, the patients were robbing her because she couldn't charge them the same fees that she could charge the other folks. We felt that was kind of an issue of maybe we didn't need to have this particular program going. But so there's good and there's bad. I don't think that anyone can walk in and everyone's going to be a pleasant experience. But that the ones that work really well, and it really is a very good and a natural fit. We have a community health center that's the public health clinics of Indianapolis. It's the health and hospital system, and they operate 5 family planning clinics within their session, and that's worked like a dream. We both have the same target population. They're very comfortable with it being a separate service, and so we're able to put the emphasis on it. And one of the reasons that I think you want to have the separate service is family planning is more than handing out a prescription. Just like I think the STD folks in the room, STD is more than just taking a test and giving a shot or some pills. There's a whole lot of counseling and education, screening for risk, and working to get the person into taking care of their sexual health. It's not the same as a cold. And so I think that's one of the things that you have to work and be very careful with when working with community health centers. It really, I came down to, with my difficult ones, it really, the bottom line was a control issue. Who controls these services? Who controls this? And if you get into a place where the director insists on total control of everything and no outside interference, it isn't going to work. Another is the conflict with the practices and guidelines that we use. Our program happens to be one very heavy with rules and regs and things you have to do, and is very closely monitored. And that's not the way that the community health centers are set up. And then basically, like in anything we do in life, it has to do with personalities. And where we have personality clashes, it didn't work. Where we have personalities with the same kind of outlook on how we wanted the services provided, it worked quite well. But I think there are some positive points that for family planning, and I, with my half STD cap on, I think that works for STD too. And one is we serve the same target population. We are looking at low-income people, people with health disparities, and so that we do have access to the same or need to have the same population to serve. There's a lot more access geographically, particularly within states that have a high rural population. If there's been so many increases with the community health centers that there now are possibilities of getting services into some areas that we haven't been able to with Title X. One of the things, too, and I don't know that this works for STD, but it does for family planning, is that we can attract the underserved population. Well, I guess it would for STD, too. We get the people want birth control so that, and they will go to a clinic to get it if the clinic has a good reputation. And I suspect if they need STD services that there is an urgency to that, too. And one of the things that we see in family planning is that once they make contact with us, usually the woman in the situation is takes the health direction for the family, so they usually bring the family in. At our health and hospital in Indianapolis, when they open up a new community health center, they ask us to put a family planning clinic in because their experience has been that when we have a family planning clinic, that they don't have to do as much marketing. Once you get family planning in there, the moms go for the adult care, they bring their kids in for pediatrics, and there's the OB, and they fill that clinic pretty quickly. So there is, I think in some ways, we do have a population we can attract. And I think that we need to know that our expertise is valuable and that it's needed and that it is a special expertise and it does have a special emphasis that you're not going to get in a general practitioner. And so that we do have values and we do have a lot of skills that we can bring into the process. So, my whole thing was about having the good and the bad and the ugly is that, like everything in life, it's not always going to have a perfect outcome. I can't give you the checklist and say this is going to work perfectly, but I think it's worth a try and just be aware that there's going to be bumps and there's going to be ups and downs in it. But overall, we've been quite happy with the community health centers within our system.
So before we ask Bill to respond to these assertions we've made, I'd love to see if there are any questions from the audience. Thanks.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, my name is Eileen Barandas. I'm a nurse practitioner with the California Family Health Council, and I spend a lot of time going out to clinics assessing whether or not they are providing the family planning and FGD services that we are giving them funding to provide. And my issue has been with the FQHCs is that they really don't incorporate the FGD services or the family planning services into their clinics. They'll take the money, and they're happy about that, but they're kind of resistant to providing IUCs and screening for chlamydia and, you know, all the basics that we take for granted and that we see when you go to, like, a Planned Parenthood that, you know, they take care of really easily. So I'm wondering whether there's been any talk of, like, HEDIS-type measures for the FQHCs where you would be expected to be able to provide IUCs or expected to, have syphilis treatment on site or even whether there are any family planning indicators, like, do you collect LNP at every visit? Do you check for birth control method at every visit? Those are my questions.
I'm going to take that if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So thanks for the question. I think there are two answers from the family planning side of the ledger, and Bill may have thoughts from the STD side. I would say there's two things happening. One, the increased resources going into federally qualified health centers will lead inevitably to conversations about comprehension and quality of their services. And my sense from working with those partners at the federal level is that they are becoming more and more aware of the increasing expectation and the accompanying pressure. So there's two things I want to mention. The first is we believe in the next 4 to 6 weeks, there'll be the first study we've seen from the George Washington University School of Public Health looking at the quality of family planning service delivery in the federally qualified health centers. It's not going to compare FQHC systems to Title X, because frankly, that's not fair to them. But if they're going to compare federally qualified health centers to each other, and one of the things they're going to look at is, does the addition of federal family planning resources lead to a higher quality and more comprehensive program? So you're in a system where you are the Title X grantee putting money into a community health center system and expecting them to meet the standards of the program. This study will go directly to that question and look at, without dedicated funds to support family planning services delivery, do you actually get real services? And I have this conversation quite a lot around the country and at the federal level, because my thesis is they're not doing it as well as we're doing it in specialized centers of any kind, whether they're county health departments that have STD clinics and family planning integrated, whether they're sitting in Planned Parenthood or at an Indiana Family Health Council sponsored system or at a California Family Health Council system. We think the differentiation is making a difference. But that study will be the first national level information we have about where is it going well and what are the factors that drive quality service delivery. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I think in the family planning and sexual health community we have our eye on is that, unlike the STD community, we don't right now have treatment guidelines coming from the CDC that sort of set a national standard of care for the work that we do in contraception and sexual health. But it appears to be the intent of the Office of Population Affairs in its ongoing work to revise and modernize the Title X guidelines to move us more towards an evidence-based standard of care and to use that standard of care to promote beyond the grantee system, the federally funded system, this idea that there is a standard for what high-quality, comprehensive family planning care looks like. So in the STD community, we have that, right? That's what the CDC does for this community, and it has broad impact across a wide class of service providers. The family planning community has not ever had similar guidelines, and that appears to be the intent of an effort that's going on right now inside the federal government in a partnership between the CDC and the Office of Population Affairs, which is the oversight agency for the Title X Family Planning Program, to get at that idea of a national standard. So that would go beyond just the systems that get direct money and really speak to the academic community, to clinical training, and to every kind of health center setting there will be in the country. Bill, I don't know if you have anything.
I'll hold it.
Okay.
Hi, Beth Meyerson from Indiana University. I don't know if you guys are aware of what's going on in Indiana, but Gayla, you seem very calm as we approach this gubernatorial election, and I feel for us if we have Pence as the governor, because it's going to make the kinds of state-level policy decisions that will have to occur in ACA implementation very difficult. So two quick questions off of this one. One is there a paired STD study that's a national review of how FQHCs are delivering STD studies, A. B, because this is a state-level process, Gayla, I'm wondering if you guys have thought about or maybe even already done some kind of a feasibility evaluation of FQHC partners, I don't know whether it would be administrators / clinicians, for their readiness to implement sexual health services.
So I think the first Beth, part of the question is for Bill.
And Beth, can you repeat that? I didn't hear the whole part of your first question about whether there's a comparable.
Is there a similar study coming?
You were mentioning the George Washington study on FQHC quality indicators around sexual health, really. But it was more family planning.
Correct.
So the question was, okay, great. Do we have a partner one around STD evaluation in some way?
I have lots of... Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. There are lots of CDC and other STD-focused research folks in the room who may know, but I don't believe that there is. I mean, obviously what we know is that the vast majority of STD diagnoses are taking place outside of siloed clinical sort of focus settings for some time now. But I don't believe there's ever been sort of an assessment on are those services being delivered well in culturally appropriate ways and that. I don't believe that that has ever been done or that it's in the works.
And to the extent that this study will touch on STD issues, I just want to point out that of the 5.2 million people seen in Title X family planning settings, nearly half of them are screened for chlamydia and gonorrhea. We do 1 million confidential HIV tests every year, and we serve more than 750,000 people for syphilis testing, screening and testing. So and we're also a major partner in the IPP programs sponsored by CDC. Half the IPP services are delivered in the family planning setting. So we think of this as family planning and sexual health. In some of our systems, it is explicitly integrated family planning STD. In other systems, it is not. But STD work is very important work in the family planning setting, and there has been a particular focus on HIV in the family planning setting. And in the last 10 years, our rate of testing for HIV has risen 64% in the family planning system. So I think Dr. Curran in his opening session last night talked about family planning as a partner, and we have to say we could not agree more. We really feel like we have come to the table in a way to produce good collaboration, good cooperation, and there's so much more opportunity in our judgment to really become a sexual health system under the Affordable Care Act. So now Gayla will answer the Indiana question.
Are you referring to Mike Pence? I think many of you know that he.
No
is,
names.
Oh, no, 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 he's running for governor. We're giving him some publicity. He's a congressman of Indiana who has championed on the federal stage the defunding of Planned Parenthood. And he is running for unopposed in the Republican primary for governor and more than likely will win the governorship. And it does bring a lot of concern to us in the family planning community in Indiana. Now, he loves community health centers, or so he says, and his favorite one is the one we have five clinics with. So he claims that it's just Planned Parenthood that he has a problem with. But one of the things I always say about Indiana is it's real nice because they don't give us anything to take away. So it's not easy to threaten us. We're not going to lose anything in the process. So we had a little battle this last summer with the state legislature trying to defund Planned Parenthood. And the federal court stepped in and said they couldn't do it without a ruling from Medicaid to take that form, which was the one they were most concerned with. The other piece of it, they really didn't word it right on the legislation because the council received all of the state's federal pass-through money for family planning, and it only said the person who received it from the state couldn't do abortions. So we finally got an agreement between our lawyers that that's what it meant. And anyway, we had twice as much federal money as state money, so that we had already kind of moved it around so that we told Planned Parenthood they would be funded regardless. So they can try troubles, and like if they want to take their federal pass-through money away from the council, you know, no sweat. We do more. I hope no one from the state's here, but we do a lot of services for $50,000 a year. So in running their part of the grant, so it's, you know, it's playing the politics of it. It's been even without Mike Pence, when Mitch Daniels decided to run for governor, he got pretty conservative, and our health department has been fairly conservative over the last 3 or 4 years. So regardless of who's at the top, we expect it to probably continue.
Kathy, I have a repeatability
Well, I would be more than glad to work with someone on that.
And I think you're going to see a lot of follow-up after GW's study comes out. And I think Kevin Cranston talked this morning about how Massachusetts has followed through on what the impact has been on service delivery. So I want to go, oh, I went the wrong way. I'm always bad about the slides. I want to give Bill an opportunity now to respond. One of the things, Bill and I work together quite a lot, and I think he's extraordinary. And one of the things that we argue about is whether or not what we're saying from the family planning, sexual health part of the community really makes sense to our colleagues in the STD community. Because I think of us as being all together, but I recognize there are pretty significant distinctions in program, in approach, and in culture between our two parts of the community. So I was anxious to have Bill say, like, that doesn't make any sense. And I trust that he'll tell us what makes sense and what doesn't.
Well, let me thank Claire. It's a bit of a mutual admiration society because I have worked with her for a long time, and we work together quite closely. I hope we're modeling Pixie in a very cool way at the national level by the type of collaboration and coordination that we've been doing, particularly around impacts of healthcare reform and reimbursement and billing. As a way of intro, when we came in, someone said to Claire, I really want to come to your session, but there's a gonorrhea resistance session and I really want to go to it, right? Listen, I am so excited about talking about antibiotic resistant gonorrhea, so I get it. But I think what's also interesting is that the folks that I can see in the room who are my folks, who are the STD sort of specific folks, are attached to IPP in some way. So that, in fact, most of them are already part of the discussion around family planning and actually understand the importance of why we're holding this session. I have always said, and I follow Claire around blindly because I feel like family planning has been miles ahead of STD, and I think STD, frankly, is miles ahead of some other parts of public health. In this entire focus on what impacts of healthcare reform means and rushing to figure out how we diversify revenue, because there's a whole other session later on safety net, but the bottom line is that for STD clinical services as a siloed sort of approach, that financing mechanism has been in deep collapse for so long. We've all seen it. We've seen clinic hours cut back to 2 or 3 hours a week. We've seen staff laid off, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. So that has been in free fall for a long time. But what we haven't seen from the STD side is the opportunity to seek out other sources of revenue to ensure the services continue. So when I said yesterday during my opening remarks, and very briefly, that of course there are challenges with ACA and healthcare reform implementation. And honestly, depending on which day I get up, I am either completely overwhelmed and feel like we're ahead of that there's an impossible task ahead of us, or I feel incredibly optimistic. But on most days, what I think is most important to underscore is that for STDs and my folks, the STD programs at the state, territorial, and large city level, the Affordable Care Act creates tremendous opportunities for us to ensure that the populations we care about and the services we are charged to ensure are delivered are expanded. But it requires us to think really differently about many, many, many things. And Kevin struck me with a couple things this morning that I'll talk a little bit about. So we're absolutely playing catch up. And so I don't really disagree with anything Claire said or anything that Gail said. But I think what's important from my members' perspective, and it's a little different at the local level. We've got some really great local examples where this statement I'm about to say is not true. Thinking about what partnering with an FQHC looks like and the essential elements of what that looks like and all the challenges one experiences in getting there skips a couple steps of where the STD programs are. Now, that's not true, again, for a number of local programs where there's some really innovative stuff going on, and we have a couple of resources coming out about that. But I think that helps explain why we continue to press this and why, for example, at the NCSD annual meeting, I have Claire's came the last 2 years, Julie Schofield's come from NASTAD, and we do big panels on sexual health care provision and the impacts of the Affordable Care Act. So if I think about what this means for my members, the job of states, and Stu Berman, who's sitting up here, who's a friend of mine and is absolutely brilliant, always triggers things for me. So in our brief discussion before this session, Stu was like, what's the role of the states? And from NCSD's perspective, that's exactly what we're focused on. What is the role of the state, territorial, and those couple eight large cities that CDC directly funds? What is the role of those members in ensuring the provision of sexual health services and STD services under the Affordable Care Act? And it seems to me as though, yes, of course, part of that is the behavioral interventions that we know are important, delivery of field therapy, which lots of folks are experimenting with, surveillance, all of those other pieces. But yes, part of our job is to make sure that STD services are being delivered in a competent, culturally competent, and accessible fashion. And I think what we have heard from a number of our members is not dissimilar, I think, from what Claire said, which is we try to talk to the FQHC, and they're just not interested. But here's what I would sort of focus back on STD programs, which is we haven't even begun to make the case. And that the FQHCs and others including primary docs, who we may be looking to pick up and develop an expertise in STD clinical services because our siloed STD clinics might be going away, or even, you know, into an integrated setting where perhaps HIV, TB, and family planning are being provided. They need help to understand why they should do this work. And let me start with, I think, the first important piece, which is that we are still not accustomed to thinking about this as a business. One of the things I always learned, even before I got to NCSD, primarily from my family planning experience, because it's even less remote to the HIV world, is that these services aren't just being provided because we believe in it, which of course we do, which is why you go through the machinations you need to go through of banging your head against CHCs who create challenges for you. But we have to make a business case for why that happens, because these other providers may not carry that same conviction that this is rights-based or whatever that happens to be. So let me talk a little bit about why I think the business model is so critical, and let me give you one quick example. So I get excited about this, and I did this with my board of directors the other day. I'm very excited about this one thing that we're working on, which is what we've discovered from most of our members who continue to provide clinical services is that they're no longer seeing external genital wart patients. And they're not seeing them because there are so many of them that they can't fit them into their clinic hours. So if they see a wart patient, they can't see their chlamydia patient, or they can't do screening of partners of people who've already tested positive for CT or GC. So I was scratching my head, and I'm like, that's so strange to me. You know, like, I understand it's a resource question, right? It's a resource question. But then I thought, well, if the Affordable Care Act creates opportunities for us to generate revenue, and these patients aren't being seen, and we find that, you know, we did a series of focus groups on EGWs with one of our industry partners. And, you know, you find out all these weird things about people doing self-treatment for EGW, some really creepy stuff that we heard from some of the clinicians. Blah, it was really. But then we were thinking, you know, what does a business model look like to run a wart clinic? What does patient flow look like? And given that there are physician-applied and patient-applied therapies, and you incorporate that into a one-day wart clinic a week or something like that, how much money can you generate in a day? So we're working on that model, because if you can get reimbursed for all of those wart patients, you don't need lab service for those, you know, you don't need a lab to look to diagnose an external genital wart. You can do it like this. But we've got to put those business models together, because if we're not doing the wart clinic, we may want to say to this other partner that we want to pick up these services that, yeah, I know some of this is challenged, but some of it's really easy, and you're losing out on lots of money. And this is a really common STD. And that this outcome of HPV-related disease is easily treatable, easily diagnosed, and you're leaving money on the table. That is just, I think, one small example. Holly's laughing at me because she knows I get too excited about things like this. That is just one example of putting forward this business model that we have never thought about in the STD world. And my members, for the most part, have never thought about, because we haven't had to. We've never thought about diversification of revenue. We've never thought about what reimbursement rates look like for these things. But this is where we're headed. So if we're not actually providing those clinical services, I would suggest, and certainly we're providing resources and urging our members, to speak about why this is a potential opportunity for additional revenue for these other providers. Now, our family planning partners who are doing a lot of this STD work already know, if they're doing reimbursement for a lot of these services, that there's money there. But FQHCs, other partners who may not be taking up this service, certainly don't know that. One of the things that I found fascinating about what Kevin said this morning, it fits into this argument in the sense that of what's happening with STD clinical services as those services are diversified across new providers in Massachusetts, is that certainly we all recognize, and I don't think I need to go into it, that there are very specific pieces to sexual health care generally that other providers may not want to take up. But I think with STDs, we all think we're special. But let me just say that we're special. For STDs in particular, There are some very specialty things. Like, most docs, not that we have lots of chancroid, but most docs, if they see a chancroid, have no idea what a chancroid is, right? But I would suggest that even the same thing is true for most syphilis. So what Kevin said, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, was how did they figure out, because there's so few cases of syphilis, that if you move it into an integrated primary care setting, how do you make sure those services are provided and that treatment's provided? And I found it absolutely fascinating when Kevin talked about the switching of how they're dealing with bicillin. So how do they make sure bicillin's available? Because, no, most primary care settings are not going to have bicillin sitting around. It's too expensive, blah, blah, blah. They see too few cases. It's just it doesn't make financial sense to them to have it on hand. Now, the state of Massachusetts is also an NCSD member, so I don't want to be overly critical of the solution. But the notion that you shift from one silo of the safety net to another silo of the safety net, so instead of having an STD program principally responsible for making sure bicillin available is to making sure the TB clinics have bicillin available, may work very well in Massachusetts. I doubt it's a long-term solution. It works in Massachusetts because they've got TB issues. Lots of other jurisdictions do not have TB issues, so this may not be generalizable across the country. So that may be a novel solution, but I would also say that I'm not sure that the best use of DIS, for whom I have an enormous amount of respect for, is running bicillin over to a primary care provider somewhere across the state who diagnosed a case of syphilis. I'm not sure that that's a good use of time. But what I would say, reflecting back on this, is that I am also willing to bet, is anyone in here from Massachusetts? I am willing to bet that Fenway, which is a valued provider of sexual health care services in Massachusetts, has bicillin on hand. That there's no DIS running bicillin over to Fenway because Fenway has become a recognized provider, and it's an FQHC, is a recognized provider of sexual health care and that type of expertise. So the reason I'm bringing this up is that I would argue that particular example for me underscores that one of the roles of the states and the state, territorial, and large city STD programs is to ensure that those types of what Dr. Boland calls centers of excellence thrive under the Affordable Care Act. I'm not sure we need to train every primary health care center, FQHC, to do syphilis. But what we need to do is to make sure that we're identifying where those centers of excellence are, where those services are able to be provided. Now, for the more common STDs, CT and GC, CT in particular, I think the states also have a primary role, and this is, again, where FQHCs and other potential beneficiaries of the Affordable Care Act need some assistance from us. They may not know what the recommended screenings for sexually active populations for CT. They may not know what the recommended screenings are for MSM who come in for CT and GC and the sites that are supposed to be screened for those sorts of things. And in turn, those services may not be provided. And they may not be provided because, again, returning to the business model, we haven't told them how much money they can make by running a chlamydia test and that they can get reimbursed for it because of the grade that it gets from USPSTF. So I think there's plenty of roles here for us to think about how we take advantage of the new healthcare environment and the role of these other partners and the provision of STD services. Now, let me conclude, because I'm out of time, with two additional pieces. We are doing a session later on that Claire is part of as well and that Kevin is on safety net, so I'll save most of my remarks for there. But that doesn't mean what I'm suggesting is that public health doesn't continue to have a primary responsibility to make sure if these other services, these services are not being provided by others, that public health has to have a key role in making sure that they're available. And to that extent, those types of services may continue to be necessary from the public sector. But I think what we have is a number of models, like the one in Denver, that I think is an absolutely fabulous model. At Denver Public Health, where they have an integrated STD, HIV, and family planning clinic attached to the Denver Public Health System itself, and now they're working out a billing system between them. Those types of conglomerations of services, I think, are sort of what will be essential, even when the public sector must continue to be providing STD services because no one else is doing it in a culturally incompetent way. Now, what I want to finalize on, and it's perhaps not the happiest note, is that I would also not be surprised, for instances like my friends from Indiana have already discussed because of political types of things, or because of out of necessity of what things happen like, as Kevin presented this morning about the case, the pace with which siloed STD clinical services were shut down in Massachusetts and they scrambled to figure out for the most part how those services continue to be provided. It would not surprise me if, as the Affordable Care Act rolls out and we have increasing pressures on the provision of STD services and where they're provided, that we find that they're not being provided well and that we see huge explosions in disease in certain jurisdictions. That's not the outcome any of us want, but I think it's the likely outcome if we think that the Affordable Care Act is going to take care of all of this on its own. So there's a compelling notion for all of us to undertake some of the challenges that we've talked about, including this notion that you must try and figure out how to partner with FQHCs and other winners under the Affordable Care Act, or else I think that's the likely outcome. And then we're trying to backtrack and figure out how we stomp out, you know, a syphilis outbreak or a GC outbreak among MSM. So those are sort of just my thoughts, and I'll stop there.
Good. So great opportunity for Bill to generate some thoughts and questions from you as well. So we're going to open it back up for questions. It would be helpful, I think. And someone's going to beat you to it. It'll be a race to the microphone.
Hi. Holly Howard from the California Department of Public Health. I just have a question about FQHCs in general and community health clinics and the future of Title X. And around quality assurance, and who holds, I heard Bill talk a lot about making sure that our role in the future ensures that these health centers, you know, give quality care and et cetera, et cetera. But there needs to be some sort of, they need to be held accountable to that. They have to be accountable to something in order to allow us to be in there working with them, assuring that there's quality, et cetera. And I wondered what at the federal level, whether through whatever different government agencies, HR, HRSA or OPA or CDC, if there's a mandate for ensuring that quality assurance activities are happening, and then would allow us to direct to quality improvement activities.
So I think there are two questions, one specific to federally qualified health centers and the second a broader point related to the drive towards quality measurement inside the Affordable Care Act or through the funding in the Affordable Care Act. The federally qualified health centers that are working under the Section 330 federal funds do not have well-delineated quality standards for any of their clinical services. Gayla referred to the fact that Title X is one of the most prescriptive categorical grant programs on earth. We are extremely detailed in what you have to do and how you have to do it at the moment. And the FQHC systems are extraordinarily different. They do not have clinical standards, for example. They refer their systems to nationally recognized clinical standards, but they are not delineated in the program regulations or the program guidelines. So I don't think you find today in the federally qualified health center system that they're referring to a federal oversight for their quality measurement or management. Certainly all of these clinical programs have clinical quality management and broader quality management. That's a trend that has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act, but has been a part of where healthcare is going for quite some time. And those of us who have worked with clinician teams know that at the monthly clinician meeting, you're working through measures, issues of quality, discussing risk and things of that nature. The Affordable Care Act, though, puts a big emphasis on this notion of measuring quality in a more assertive and thorough way. And frankly, we expect that it will be very closely tied to payment. There is this sense that you can drive payment to get higher quality outcomes, And, you know, this is, again, predates the ACA and has to do with some really extraordinary work being done in university systems and by researchers all across the country to see if driving better outcomes should then drive reimbursement. So we do think that the Affordable Care Act kind of sets the table for a conversation about quality, whether they're HEDIS measures or measures that an insurance company is going to use to track its effectiveness in covering a patient population. We'll think there'll be a lot of different quality measures that are coming. We know that Gail Boland has talked a lot about quality indicators, measurements for the STD community. There is a beginning conversation in the Title X community. We collect an enormous amount of data, but it doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the quality of our care. It tells you a great deal about the volume of our care. So there's a shift in our thinking about, you know, whether or not the number of something really tells you about the value of the services that are provided. I think Title X is behind STD at this point. I don't get a chance to hear from the STD team at CDC as often as so many of you do, but in my opportunities to hear from Dr. Boland and her team, it seems to me that they are doing some really smart, both practical and innovative thinking about how quality is going to reshape this environment. I think in the family planning community, we're kind of chasing after that vision now.
Hi. I have a question. I've heard that there are conversations between HRSA, CDC, OPA, probably CMS, I hope, as well, about some of these issues that you were discussing. And just to give a little background to it, I work as a Title X family planning nurse, and about a year and a half ago, we brought on a community health center. It's not yet achieved FQHC status, but it recently became a medical home provider for a huge portion of our state. And that community health center recognized that family planning services and SCD care were sorely needed by the population there. We have lots of data to support that. And they really had the heart to want to provide those services, but they lacked adequate resources to be able to do it very well. And so they were willing to try to implement Title X. I'm not a politician, so I'm trying to be careful how I say anything.
Just say what you need to say.
Pardon?
Just say it however it works for you. You're not a politician. Don't worry.
Well, let
and
me
you
give...
didn't tell us where you're from, so they can't find
yeah,
you ever
I'm not
again.
Saying my state.
Turn it over.
Well, let me just give one example. One of the things that Title X wants to know is, out of all the women who had a clinical breast exam, how many were referred on for some kind of other care?
Yeah.
The descriptions that involve this data are not well described. The word cancer or suspicious for cancer are never used, and yet there is this sort of electronic, or not electronic, but like telepathy, memory, something out there that says you don't include screening mammography amongst that group.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this brand new clinic trying to comply with everything reported that a quarter of the women that they'd done clinical breast exams on had been referred on. Well, you know,
that was a scary referral, yeah.
It was a goof up. And so now they need to go back and spend a lot of time and figure out how to give Title X what they want. There isn't really any system for doing it. And that just sounds like maybe one really small piece, but it's a piece of many, many, many very, very similar things related to their effort to implement Title X.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, I would just say that this clinic has the heart to provide the services that are needed, the kind that we all care about here. They're not perfect at it, but they want to improve. They did things like implement a very excellent reproductive health history that was shared with them before they were, what they were doing was like, ah! And they have high-risk population. But they knew that, and they wanted to get better, so they implemented it right away. and they're not afraid of counseling. They counsel people with chronic diseases, and they want to, you know, do a good job. It just seems to me that the rules and regulations of Title X have made it so onerously expensive for them to implement it. They're now on the brink of saying, we're just not even sure we can do this.
This is worth it, yeah.
So I think my question is, what are the conversations that are going on, you know, at the leadership level to heal this problem so that they can care for people because they want to?
There are so many important points in what you had to say, so I want to thank you for raising them. And I'm going to speak from NIFR's perspective about our love-hate relationship with the Title X program around the country. Those of us who've worked in Title X, and I have been a delegate system leader, so I'm not speaking from an academic point of view, but from the point of view of someone who ran a Title X network, 35,000 patients and 11 health centers. There's a real love-hate relationship, right? We love the mission. We love our call to quality comprehension and compassion, and the rules are making us crazy. And the rules, as you've so beautifully illustrated, discourage us from partnering, discourage us from helping people along the way. So there's sort of three things in what you said that I'd love to address. The first is there a national conversation? And the answer is, there certainly is. And the vehicle has been this modernization and revision of the Title X program guidelines. The Title X program guidelines were last reviewed in 2001. That was an 8-year review process. And it now, of course, because clinical standards have moved so quickly and the practices in the field continue to innovate and change, these guidelines are sorely out of date. In 2009, the Office of Population Affairs put out a program instruction that essentially said to the field, we get that the guidelines now are not keeping pace with the change in clinical practice, so look to nationally recognized standards. Look to ACOG, look to the American Cancer Society, and then now we're able to look to the CDC medical eligibility criteria as places where clinicians and programs, grantees like GALA, can look for direction about the clinical services. But, so we've got some help there, but there's still a long way to go. I referenced earlier the difference between community health centers and Title X family planning centers when it comes to our sliding fee scales, what we can or cannot charge patients, and some of what our approaches are. So this guidelines revision process that is more than a year underway now, is going to look at all aspects of the program. So try to move us in the direction of evidence based work in our clinical practice, move us towards best practices, promising practices, and effective interventions in our education, counseling, and outreach work, our community engagement, and then we hope and expect it will try to flatten some of these mountainous, ridiculous differences between programs so that we can partner more effectively together. Another point you raised, I think, goes to data. And the Title X system is cursed by a system called the Family Planning Annual Report, or the FPAR. And in the document NIFRA passed out for the rest of this session, we actually refer to the Family Planning Annual Report. It's the data that's reported delegate by delegate into grantee and then up to the federal level. That's how we count. And as I just mentioned, we count a lot of things. We don't necessarily have that stuff lead to quality conclusions or usable evidence that can change the way the practice is delivered out in our service settings. And I think some of the problems and concerns we're having in partnership are about data collection around clinical services or other services, but also about financial data collection. Trying to partner with an organization that is collecting a lot of data, but expecting them to put a family planning or a sexual health cost center together and report to you in a way that helps you answer the questions in the FPAR is a big challenge. So the bad news is the Title X revision, guidelines revisions process does not get to the FPAR. But I think for so many folks who work in our systems, there is a very, very high level of concern about why we're collecting the data we're collecting, how it's used, how to even interpret what you're being asked to report,
And then how does that fit in with all the other kinds of quality measures and collecting of data that will be required as we work with other payers? You know, in my system in New York, we were about 35% Medicaid, about 48% sliding fee scale uninsured, and the balance was commercial insurance. So we had a team of staff that were sorting out what we had to report to different funding entities, payer sources, all across the year. In STDs, you may not be working in a system that has that kind of complexity now, but under the ACA, we all will be working in a system that has that kind of complexity. So trying to get to some core measures of quality, what are we going to report consistently to each source that is funding us, I think is a really key question. And as I said before, I think Dr. Boland has been articulating some very smart, practical things along how STDs are going to change the way they think about their reporting. I am hoping that the Title X system will pay close attention and begin to move in that direction. It's very, very important for our future.
I want to jump in before we get real excited that the new guidelines are going to make things, or that it can be negotiated away into a very smooth system. Part of, I think, the distressing part of the guidelines, the ones that irritate folks the most and the ones that seem to be the biggest barriers are in the legislation establishing Title X, and therefore they're going to be with us until the legislation is changed. And I think everyone realizes that the political climate is not one that we'd want to open up those guidelines or to open up the legislation and the required things, so that what we're seeing are, I think, with the new guidelines are ways to make it much easier to handle those parts of the guidelines that aren't part of the legislation.
And Gayla and I don't have the same position on that issue. Okay, any other questions, or else we actually have more to go. Penny's coming. Sure.
So, she drops a huge kernel and then moves on, right?
So yeah. There's the Title X law and the Title X regulations. And things like our sliding fee scale are in the regulation. So Gayla is saying the guidelines are the sub-instructions that are underneath the law and the regulations. They sit underneath. So Gayla's saying that, you know, the regulations aren't going to be touched. Nothing can happen to them. And I'm saying I disagree because I think something can be done. And nobody knows better than me the political environment, since I have to live it every day in Washington on your behalf. But I have a really difficult time with the fact that we are in an administration that passed this Affordable Care Act, that is asking us to make these adjustments that are going to bring 32 million people into care, and then are saying to us, like, sorry, we don't have the power to fix your sliding fee scale disagreement. I just don't accept that. I get that it's a political challenge, but I don't accept it can't be done.
So I'm Penny from CDC, and this question might be a little beyond the scope of this, but, you know, Medicaid, every time I hear it explained to me, I think I understand it, and then I go away and I don't understand it at all. But with the expansion, you're going to see a significant increase in the number of men who are now eligible for services, and they're not going to have the same sort of mandate that you have within Medicaid for family planning services, I don't think. And even though the preventive services recommendations from the USPSTF, et cetera, apply primarily to the group and private insurance, you know, maybe they'll make their way into Medicaid, but they're not there yet. So how are we going to handle men in this new setting, and especially in FQHCs, when you're going to have, 19 million new people coming in the next couple of years? A significant portion are men who have never been in healthcare to begin with. And so that might be a little bit beyond the scope of this, but I was wondering if you had thoughts about that.
So I'm going to ask Bill to answer it. And, I think men will be seen in the family planning clinics, right? And that's what happened in Massachusetts. The numbers are rising in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Gayla and I both looked at each other and said, they're just still not going to come. Just because they now have access to coverage doesn't mean that they're going to come. But you know, Claire's quite right. So if we're talking specifically about STDs, sort of now where are they going to go, given that they typically come to the categorical STD clinic, which may or may not be there. Again, I think this notion of identifying centers of excellence, which is really just a shifting of, in my mind, the simplest way to describe it, from the patient-focused, if you're thinking about the patient on the other end, the easiest way to describe it is letting them know that that clinic's not there anymore and there's something very similar over here and it's still covered. It's still free. That's the easiest way, I think, to describe and make sure that those men are continuing to receive STD services. But again, besides, you know, when they become symptomatic, I don't think you're going to, you know, it's not like men are going to rush in just because they've got coverage now. They're men. Yep. Sorry.
And there is a bigger question, I think, about Medicaid, but we don't have time to talk about it. Okay, so we have very few minutes left, and part of the promise of this session was that we would talk to you about essential elements. So the good news is you have a handout that raises the key questions. And so what I'm going to do is just touch on a few in the limited amount of time we have left, and then certainly I can hang around after if people want to talk about any specific idea or recommendation that we're making. So NIFR put together this list of 15 essential elements after surveying our own members about agreements that exist already. We know that a lot of our systems are working in partnership with different kinds of systems. So what you see up on the slide is the different kinds of agreements that NIFR was given when we asked our 400-plus members to share with us some of the agreements that they had with other primary care or service delivery systems. So we have about 50 members that reported that they have some sort of agreement, and we've read many, many, many agreements. So the handout that you have summarizes sort of our best wisdom of what we've seen in agreements and the key factors around each of those elements. But as I said, in the interest of time, I'm going to touch on one on each slide. So for me, on this slide, you don't see them all. Okay. So if you're following along on your handout, I'm talking about 1, 2, and 3. So the 3 that you don't see on the slide is provision of services and staffing. But I want to talk about referral. Because to me, on this slide, the most important thing is, can you get an agreement? And by agreement, I mean a memorandum of understanding or a contract. I don't mean Claire has a good relationship with Bill, and so if she has a question, I call him. That's not what I mean. A lot of us have that in place. We know the person down the street who runs the community health center. We talk about problems. They dump patients on us. We refer patients to them. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a memorandum of understanding or a formal contract. But I don't want you to be scared by the term. Think about it as an agreement. We are looking for two-way referral. What we see is a lot of one-way. So referral from the more specialized system to the larger system of care. It's that we're happy to take your referral problem, that all the care goes out and none of it comes back. We really think that it's very, very important to support our case that we have quality, we have comprehension, we have compassion, we have expertise. Our workforce sees more, does more, can handle more than their workforce. The way to show it is dual referral. It's got to go both ways. So the most important thing of those first three is working out a way so that your patients don't just leave you and go to a comprehensive system, but that the comprehensive system is saying, great, we recognize your expertise and we're going to send people to you. I'm going to pick confidentiality on this one. So in sexual health, in all healthcare certainly, confidentiality matters. In sexual health, it's paramount. So we think that you've got to have explicit conversations about what your understanding of confidentiality is and what your funding sources require. In the Title X system, we have an extraordinary protection for the confidentiality of our patient care. It is central to the mission of what we do, and one of the conflicts we have when we work with primary care is that they don't have the same protection. So they're going to follow state law as their governing rule, and we have a federal rule that we also must adhere to. We must do both, follow state law and adhere to our federal standard. So this conversation about confidentiality is essential, and it's one of the places where it's hard to build trust, because if you've had a relationship with a community health center and they've let you down before, thinking about entering into a more binding or more formal agreement, this is a big place where understanding has to be crystal clear. Well, this doesn't seem very exciting, this slide, does it? Okay, I'm going to focus here on data collection. And this goes to the point that was raised earlier. Big, big trouble in these agreements about will there be adequate collection. So what's going to happen is the finance staff at the primary care entity is going to say, we don't have time to collect all this stuff for you. Family planning is in a separate service. If someone comes in for an STD screen and test, that's not a separate service. That's just a primary care visit, right? They're going to say they can't differentiate our services that we're seeking from what they do. This is just what we do. But this issue of can you actually get the primary care system to give you the data you need so that you can do the reporting that you must do, and if you have a monitoring function through that money that you're sharing with them, that you can actually monitor them, is very, very important. And I have to say, the first version of this that we did, this point wasn't there. but one of the things NIFRA does is once we write documents like this, we field test it. So I've taken this document all around the country, and it was our members who said, you're missing a big one, and it's data collection. So I want to call that out, because I think in the STD community, you're all about data as well. So here's three more. Also doesn't sound terribly exciting. So let's focus on access to books and record keeping on this slide. Again, this is a very similar thing, data collection, access to books. What I'm talking about here is, can you get the historical data you might need to answer an audit or a retrospective question? That's going to be important with insurance appeals or Medicaid audits. When a funder comes back to you and says, we want to look at all the claims that you've put in for a certain service set from X date to Y date, you have got to be able to get access to data. So you've got to have agreements about how long information is going to be kept and who has access to it. And I just want to mention, as long as I'm here, that the compliance we're talking about is not compliance in the clinical sense. In this sense, I'm talking about compliance with the agreement that you make. So let's say we make an agreement. I'm Claire Coleman Health, you're DeSantis Family Health, and I need access to your records and you deny it to me. In this case, compliance is about what does DeSantis Family Health pay? What's the penalty for denying my entity access to records that I am required to have because I need to answer an audit or I need to file an insurance appeal? So I know compliance has a general understanding in our community, and this is not the way we mean it when we're talking about compliance. So this one, on this slide, I just want to talk briefly about advertising and publicity. This is something that we don't see that much of, but I think it's a really extraordinary and interesting thing to put into an agreement. So we have seen some agreements where there's an explicit understanding about when and how one entity or the other will publicize the partnership. So in some parts of the country, an alliance between a sexual health or a women's health provider is going to be a very strong selling point for our primary care system. They're going to want to tout the idea that they've got that expertise now in their network and their patients are going to have access to this kind of quality care. In other parts of the country, there's going to be a sense that you want to keep everything underground, right? People have to wear hoods and walk around with assumed names. So there are some agreements that we've seen that actually explicitly set out what are the rules for advertising, placing ads in the newspaper or social marketing efforts, or publicity, doing a, you know, pitching a story to a local newspaper, for example, about a service that's now being offered in the community. We think that's actually quite smart to try to seek those kind of agreements. So we have been presenting these elements all around the country for well over a year. Almost a year, sorry. And we get a lot of feedback from our members who work in family planning and sexual health settings. And we're going to continue to revise this document as we go. One of the things I would say is that one of the really big reactions we've heard, and I think it will cheer some of you up, is that there's no way, our members tell us, there's no way that you're going to get all 15. That it's not realistic to think that you're going to be able to negotiate every single one of these points. So our members are saying to us, listen, systems need to know these are the kinds of questions that are important to think about. Systems need to know where they'd come down on each of these questions, what's most important to them if they were to negotiate an agreement with a primary care provider. But they need to understand and accept that maybe they'll get four. So it's really important to decide which are the four that are most important, impactful for your program, your set of services. And I think this gives you a good menu and good food for thought about what are the types of specific things you would have to think about. You know, Bill said earlier, and I think it's such an important point, that there's a couple of steps sometimes that our STD partners need to get through in order to get to this stage. But I think it's much better for you all to have information to have in the back of your heads so that as you work through the considerations you have in your systems or in your programs, you can be thinking about, would this make sense for us and how? You really need some time because this is such new material for so many of us. So we're not going to take any questions because we're out of time, but we will hang out at the end to answer any questions you might have. Please know the time to start is now. It's not too late, and it's definitely not too early. And if there's anything we can do for you at the National Family Planning Association, we are happy to do casework for our STD partners. We work really closely with the National Coalition of STD Directors. And if you want to like us on Facebook, we're up to 799 likers. And I'd love to get to 800 by the end of the week. Thank you.